A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds. And they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
The Telegraph. The Telegraph. Podcasts.
Hi there, podcast fans. I'm Tom Gibbs. Welcome to Telegraph Audio Football Club. We're back with you with another episode of the best and worst game, or the very best of football. We still haven't thought of a formal title. The four categories we've got up for discussion today are matches seen in person, friendly games, documentaries, and for a bit of fun, haircuts. We've asked our panel to nominate their best or worst of each of those. Let's hear from them right now. Let's take you now into a series of remote audio recording facilities where I'm joined by JJ Bull. Hello, JJ. How are you?
I'm good, Tom. Good to be included, because obviously I'm not on the artwork for the podcast.
But oh, come nice on, JJ.
Welcomed come in on, such limited space. Delightful fashion.
Limited space on the new artwork. Maybe we'll have like a rotating third slot like the plinth in Trafalgar Square.
That's fine. If you've seen the artwork on Twitter, at Tom Gibbs and ask where JJ Bull is.
Fair enough. Someone else who is on that artwork, it's Mina Rizuki. What's happening, Mina?
Well, I feel very flattered that I am on the artwork, but
yeah, you've made it.
I know, Tom. I just feel like, you know, it made my week go by that much easier. But yeah, excellent. Otherwise I'm okay.
Excellent. Matt Law, what are your views on the new AFC artwork?
I've got lots of problems with the artwork. I'll accept that maybe my image shouldn't be on it, and it's probably best for all that it's not. But what's the pitch? It's not a football pitch.
It's it's a loose approximation of something.
Poor.
Let's start by talking about a very big and important topic, which is the best match we've ever seen in person. And we'll start with you, Matt. What is your nomination for this category?
So why? I would like to make it clear that this isn't because I've seen better quality football, and I've seen more sort of exciting football. But in terms of, pure madness and just being left with a sense of I can't believe what I've seen, I covered the 2007 Carling Cup final at the Millennium Stadium between Arsenal and Chelsea, the Snarling Cup final, because of all the fighting that took place. And it's always stuck with me. All the astonishment pretty much happened right at the end in stoppage time when everything just kicked off. I mean, I'll just try and briefly give a summary of what happened. So Theo Walcott puts Arsenal ahead with a really good goal, and he took Chelsea apart that day. In terms of the match, Chelsea come back and win. Drogba scores one, equalises. Then at 1-1, Diaby kicks Terry in the head by accident. Drogba scores again to put Chelsea ahead. The 7 minutes added on. Toure and Mikel go in for quite a spiky challenge. And then just the biggest brawl kicks off. I mean, Fabregas and Lampard have a massive fight, and somehow they get away with yellow cards. And what I would say as well is Terry made a remarkable recovery from being knocked out and swallowing his tongue to joining in with the celebrations afterwards.
Well, he knows how to celebrate, doesn't he, John Terry? There's something incredibly transgressive about seeing managers come onto a pitch, I think. Whenever that happens in that fight, it was like, oh, all right, something very serious has happened here. At this point, it meant a lot to both these teams. It wasn't like we're in at the moment, this tedious run of Manchester City winning it year after year. JJ, what have you got for your best game you've ever seen in person?
Well, I've hardly seen any good games in person because, as you know, I go to see Aberdeen watch Aberdeen play all the time and never get to go to Premier League games because it costs too much. But the best one I've seen was I went to see Ajax play in 2017 and they beat Roda JC, who were bottom of the league at the time, 5-1. And the football was, it was great. Like, not because the game especially was a thriller or anything like that, but the whole experience was so much more fun than it has been watching football in other places. Like, one of the best things is that you can sit and watch. Well, Justin Kluivert, Patrick's son, scored the best hat trick I've ever seen, especially in real life. You can see it on YouTube if you want to find it. But you can sit in the stand with a beer and just relax and enjoy it and watch. And there's a whole section behind the goal where everyone makes noise and there's the atmosphere comes from that, even against the team bottom of the league. The sound of football was excellent. It was that really good in my Ajax team with some of the boys breaking through, like Frankie de Jong and Donny van de Beek, and so Casper Dolberg scored as well.
This was 2017, wasn't it? So it was a year ahead of when they kind of entered the wider consciousness.
Exactly. It was when all these wonder kids were just breaking through. So like Matthijs de Ligt was in the team. And it's all these guys that I really wanted to see play because I knew them mostly off Football Manager, but because I'd read a lot about them. And so being able to see them live is really exciting because you can tell with a lot of them they were going to be superstars just from the very first touch. You can tell with some of them.
Yeah, definitely going to look at that on YouTube later. Might also watch it with a pint as you did, JJ. That definitely improves any sporting experience. What have you got, Mina?
Okay, I'm going to take you back to 2016 when Leicester City won the Premier League. And it was a game that I watched. And you remember last week I was telling you guys that I always tend to prefer the games in which I'm just there as a fan and not there on a journalist capacity. Well, it was a game between Spurs and Chelsea at Stamford Bridge.
Oh, I was at that game as well.
It was the 2-2. And basically Chelsea had this horrible season. They finished in 10th. They had sacked Mourinho because Hiddink had come in. It was just all a bit of a disaster, to be honest. As it happens when, you know, Mourinho is sacked or there's, you know, those moments where he's come to the end of his cycle. And they took on Spurs and Hazard and Fabregas, you know, said that they were determined. They were going to do everything in their power to not let Spurs win. Spurs needed to win their last three games to have a hope of claiming their first title since 1961. And obviously everyone wanted Leicester to win it. So they needed Chelsea to play their part as well. And oh my God, did they do it? It was really strange because the match had started so well. Harry Kane rounded the goalkeeper, got in a goal. Then Son came in and doubled it. And you thought, oh, okay, you know, like Chelsea have been so poor this season. You can totally see how it's going to go that way. And then all of a sudden, the game starts getting really tetchy. You know, Spurs start acting all Spursy. And then you start seeing all these fights breaking out. Willian and Danny Rose. The manager's not knowing how to contain everything. Pochettino just looks like He's so upset at this point, but wants them to win, but at the same time is trying to calm them down so they can actually win. It looks like at the time Moussa Dembele was trying to eye gouge, I think it was Diego Costa, and it was just the atmosphere was so thick and full of tension, but it was so fun where we were sitting because so many people were desperate for Chelsea to win for the sake of Leicester City. And when it happened, Harry Kane just looked like he was just... looked like he'd reached the World Cup final and was denied the final trophy. And he was like, look at all the Chelsea players, you know, celebrating like they had just won the league. And it was, they were so happy with themselves. The crowd was going insane. Everyone around us was like, come on, Leicester City, come on, Ranieri. And so it was a really fun match to go to in live. It's certainly not the best match I've ever watched, but It's like Matt was saying, you know, you like things that's full of like sort of bad tension, like it looks like the fight is going to break out any second, and those are the matches we love, right?
I've got a slightly different sort of game for this, which wasn't bad tempered, but was very exciting. And like JJ, I've grown up watching QPR, so not that much in the way of big games that everyone will remember. But I thought about this from the perspective of what game would people wish they'd been at themselves. And the one that came to mind was Palace 3, Liverpool 3, the Chris Stan Ball game, when Liverpool blew the league, basically, at Selhurst Park. And it was just one of those evenings where you were absolutely, you felt like you were watching a bit of history. The Liverpool fans, I was sat close to the Liverpool fans in the Palace end, and there was such, despite the fact that they probably knew they'd blown it away, home to Chelsea already, they were still quite buoyant and excited, and they were obviously, you know, full of joy at going ahead. And then as it started to turn, it was just magnificent. And, you know, no shade at Liverpool fans, but it was magnificent seeing the change of emotion happening so close to us. And also the Palace fans getting noisier and noisier. A memorable evening, and Selhurst Park, a great place to watch football when it's noisy. Do we think overall being at a game live is still the best way to experience football?
Sometimes I really like watching the really massive games when you're at home, if you've got some people around, or in a pub's really great. And I like being at home sometimes to watch it because you can just relax and go to the bathroom whenever you want, for example. But in a pub, sometimes you get really good atmosphere, everyone's watching the same thing. But then you can't really replace, like, one of the games I was going to choose for this was Aberdeen beat Rangers 2-1, and it was in 2005. And all I remember about the game, I don't remember anything apart from Jamie Smith scoring this 25-yard, last-minute winner. Might not even be the last minute, it just seems like that to me, because like, these little things stand out. And being in the stadium for that was amazing. But then you get the build-up, like you go to the pub first, and you go with your pals, and you go get your seat, and you get your pie, and you stand and watch it. And that's part of the whole experience of it. But I think you can enjoy it in a lot of different ways. And maybe it's because I don't go to the games as often as some fortunate people who do.
I remember watching like Champions League final, and everyone would keep getting up and going crazy. And I'm all like 5 foot three, and I just didn't get to see most of it, you know. And I'm just like, sit down, I can't see, and I'm just screaming. And yeah, I don't get to really concentrate on what's going on, because I just feel like sometimes the atmosphere is so thick and heavy, and everyone is so, like, you know, happy or whatever it is. And I don't get to really watch the stuff that I enjoy watching. So I prefer it on TV, or better when I'm with a bunch of people and we're all watching it.
Yeah, I suppose that's kind of the best of both worlds. I saw this described really well by someone recently. I can't remember who it was, but I find watching QPR on TV really difficult and much more stressful than being there in person.
Yeah, 100% with Villa.
Yeah, someone said it's because on TV it's all shot to make it all seem as dramatic as possible. So you've got these dramatic close-ups of players, and it's all swooshing around and making it seem, you know, like an action film. Whereas when you're there in person, it's more mortal, and you see like, oh, actually, it's just, you know, it's just 11 blokes like running around in a silly way, you know, trying to do this silly thing, and it makes it less stressful. But yeah, there's something almost comforting to me about watching football in person that I don't get at all watching it on telly.
What I hate about watching Villa on the TV, I mean, I find it so stressful, and I don't want to see them a million replays of them being rubbish. I know they're generally rubbish, and I can go to a match and I'll be annoyed for a split second or so when they do something rubbish, and then the play continues. When you watch it on TV and you get replay after replay of like the left back being awful or Neil Taylor doing something ridiculous, and it just winds me up so much. And that's related to another point I've made about TV on football in the past, is that I do not understand people who can watch Match of the Day when their team has lost. The season Villa went down from the Premier League, I probably didn't watch Match of the Day the whole season.
What? I don't get that at all. I like
cannot
to see
watch.
What happened.
No. I've got no interest in watching us get tonked again. Absolutely none.
I wonder if it's a big club, small club thing. Like, I like watching my team on the big screen because I feel like they look like heroes. Whereas when I go and see them live, they just look like 11 men. And I'm like, oh, this is a bit disappointing. We're paying so much money for this, you know?
Yeah, I've seen Aberdeen lose like 9-0 and then going home to watch highlights.
Oh. I can't think of anything.
I think that's called masochistic, isn't it?
Yeah
masochistic.
You're an odd fish, JJ.
Yeah.
Let's keep it on Aberdeen and ask you, JJ, about the next category, which is friendly matches. What is the best friendly ever?
So my nomination for the best friendly that I ever saw was back in, I think it was 1999. Was it 98?
It was 1999. I looked it up.
It was 99. Then it was just after the World Cup, anyway, because Aberdeen played Coventry. So Coventry came to Pittodrie. And this is just after, or a year after, the World Cup 98, when Mustafa Hadji was one of the best players at the tournament. Remember him?
Yeah, from Morocco.
He was so good. He played for Morocco. He was amazing. All these tricks. And it was a big deal that a star like Hadji was coming to Pittodrie to play, even though it's just Coventry, right? So anyway, I go to the Pittodrie with my dad. And I'm sure Joel will have the censor button ready for the end of this little story. But I go to Pittodrie, which is Aberdeen Stadium, with my dad. And we're sitting in the family stand. Lovely day. The players are out on the pitch having a little warm-up. And then in the front of the stand, ahead of me, is this big fat guy, massive guy, and his sidekick. Looked like a kind of Laurel Hardy pair. Obviously, they're just for a bit of a nuisance. I suspect now in my later years that they'd been at the pub beforehand. And then they're just watching the warm-up, having a bit of a laugh with each other. And you can see Mustafa Hadji doing keepy-ups, like really fancy ones, like catching it on his neck in the middle of the pitch. And they're going, Mustafa! 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 For ages and ages and ages and ages. And he's doing his tricks, doing his tricks. And they're really keen, really keen. Mustafa! And he looks up. He looks all excited and happy. And he's like, oh, okay. So he comes bounding over and he gets over. And they're waiting for him. And he starts climbing over the border. Just as he's halfway across, they just look at him and go, and yeah, he's sort of stuck, one leg over, the other leg stuck in their side of it, has to retreat, sort of like he's been caught with his pants down. It was one of the funniest things I've ever seen in a football stadium. So I don't remember anything about the game at all, but yeah, I remember that friendly because of that one little bit.
JJ, you said you saw Man United and Liverpool at Pittodrie. Was it a big deal to be hosting Coventry City in 1999 for Aberdeen? Was it exciting to see a Premier League team, or was this a quainter time when it was just expected?
It's kind of hard to put into context, like, because the Premier League had become this massive thing. So everyone in Aberdeen basically supports Man United because Alex Ferguson used to support Aberdeen, and conveniently Man United won everything at the time. So the Premier League was always the huge thing, always on the TV. You'd often find that pubs would show Premier League games rather than Scottish Premier League games. It would have been the time, Premiership now. So when any Premier League team came to town, it almost felt to me as though the real football team was in town. You know, that's the, right, the actual real sport had turned up rather than what we were doing, which was some nonsense thing. And you have to remember that in, I think it was 95 or 6, Aberdeen's biggest transfer was Paul Bernard for £1 million. And you had boys earning that every single month who were turning up to play for teams that were in friendlies like that. Man United was a great one when they came because you got to see all these good players. I remember when Gerrard was playing for Liverpool. So seeing Steven Gerrard on the pitch was really cool.
Lovely business. What about you, Mina? What have you got?
I struggled with this question, largely because I'm not really a fan of friendlies and tend to not really watch them. So I was trying to think of one, and then I just thought of the ICC, because that's the best friendly tournament.
Of course, the ICC.
And then I was like, okay, I really still don't remember many games. And then obviously I remembered the match over the summer in which Atletico Madrid thrashed Real 7-3, basically. And it was probably the best friendly that I've watched in a while, because the consequences were shocking. It was also the worst friendly I'd watched in a while, because it just looked like one team was so unprepared. The fallout was almost overly dramatic. Like, people, I just wanted to turn around and be like, guys, this is still just a friendly. Like, you can't actually, like, think that this is going to have huge repercussions on their season going forward. People tend to take sometimes friendlies like way more seriously than they should, and they'll be like, oh, look at them, they were amazing, or how bad they are, and you're like, yeah, but maybe they don't care, you know. This match was particularly good because of the fact that you had all the tension, and you know I love a good fight. You've got like Dani Carvajal and Diego Costa going at it, getting red cards. You could see like everyone was really upset on the Real Madrid side. Everyone was looking to Zinedine Zidane because they were like, okay, you've come back now and you have to start proving yourself, because your win rate has gone down, even though the guy had won like the Champions League basically for 3 years in a row. And then you had this Atletico Madrid side that had lost Diego Godin, Antoine Griezmann, Luis Felipe, and you know, so much more. And they had spent all this money on João Felix, who actually ended up scoring. And they went like 5-0 up in the first 50 minutes. And you were like, oh my God, they're amazing. Like, for a side that had such a huge change, that had like a mini revolution, that is supposed to be, you know, entirely different, with a different setup going forward, a different back line, no supposed leaders because they'd lost the likes of Godin and Griezmann and stuff. They were fantastic to watch. Meanwhile, Real Madrid, still looked like a side that was missing Cristiano Ronaldo. And you were like, oh my God, you know, this is, you know, João Felix is truly the kid. And then obviously, as you could see going forward, that it didn't really have any bearing over the season. And this is why a friendly is just a friendly.
Yes, but so good to get a mention for the ICC. It's been at least, at least three months.
I wanted to bring it back into our, you know.
Absolute AFC classic. Look, I think you're both getting this all wrong, because clearly where it's at with friendlies is international friendlies, which are the purest of the form. You know, where's the fun unless you can substitute, 11 players at half time? So my suggestion is England 3, Argentina 2 in 2005, which was held in Switzerland for some reason. Argentina took the lead twice, but then England roared back with Michael Owen, two very late goals from him at the end. It completely transcended its status as a friendly, this game. It felt like as it went on, it became more and more exciting. And then by the end, everyone's celebrating as if it's the World Cup final.
I remember it was kind of in the waning days of the...
Oh, it was great. It was in the waning days of the golden generation when it would give you glimpses occasionally of being amazing and like something wonderful might happen. And Rooney scored, took his goal really well off the first equaliser. But the other one I was thinking about for this category was a game that took place before Euro 96, in which the eventual runners-up of the tournament, the Czech Republic, with Patrick Berger, Pavel Nedved, Karol Poborský, great Czech team, they played Bamber Bridge in a warm-up friendly for that tournament and beat them comfortably. I think it was 9-0, and there are highlights of the whole thing, very extended highlights on YouTube, which is a great way to spend an afternoon in isolation. I believe you've gone for your worst friendly ever, Matt.
I have. Just before I start, I was surprised you didn't go for... Do you remember that QPR training game against the China Olympic team?
Yeah, but that was behind closed doors, so...
So it doesn't count.
Tough one to nominate, but that goes in the category of things that could only happen to QPR.
Incredible. But no, that's not mine either. I just thought you'd go for that. So I struggled with this for all the same reasons as Mina, apart from the fact I don't like the ICC either, so... I was struggling with this subject. So I've gone for a very kind of personal reason. So last summer, my son last summer, well, he's still four now. He'd just turned four last summer. And he'd already been to a couple of Villa home games with me, far too young, I know. And I was getting very excited about the fact that Villa had got promoted and there's a real good feeling around the club. And I spotted they were playing a friendly last June. Probably July, actually, last July, at Charlton. And I thought, that's not too bad for me to get to. But my only way of getting that past my wife was to take some childcare with me. So I offered it out to both my kids, and I couldn't get my little girl to come for love nor money. But Ozzy was very interested in coming. So it was his first away day with me. So it was all good fun, and... I can't stand a very popular American fast food chain, but even at the age of four, he sees it as the biggest treat ever. So I took him to that first to try and butter him up a little bit and make him think it's going to be the best day of his life. And then we got to the Valley. Now, I haven't been to the Valley for years, and I've only ever been in the press section, which is quite nice. I've never been in the away end. I was quite shocked when we got there. The away end is like something still out of the sort of 1980s. it's got basically just two toilets in the away end. I'm sure that's probably not legal. And it was packed out. Villa took about 4,000 fans, filled the away end. And it was packed out. Everyone, it was a nice sunny day. Everyone boozing outside and everything. And I kind of went in thinking, this toilet situation is not good with the youngster. So I got him to do his pre-match wee. And thought I was good to go. Anyway, so we get there, we get into our seats. Mistake number one, I'd forgotten that away games, everyone just stands up, particularly in friendlies, all rules out the window. So I had to sort of hold him up for most of the game. But then 20 minutes in, he turns to me with the words no dad wants to hear on an away day with a young kid and says, Daddy, I need a poo. And I was like, oh, man. I was like... You've got to be able, like, please, are you sure? Are you sure? I need a bit. I was trying to put him off. And then he's like, Daddy, I've got to go. And I'm not going to try and explain the experience. But safe to say, the toilet didn't have a toilet seat on it. And it was me trying to kind of hold him over it. And just a horrendous stroke, brilliant experience. And we saw, I've got to say, I definitely think it's around. John McGinn scored an absolute worldie that day. He scored such a good goal right down in front of us. And my little lad learned the John McGinn song that day.
Joel Grove, Charlton fan, have you got anything to say about this outrageous slur about the away end at Charlton?
I've been to the away end once when we won League One, and the only tickets you could get were in the away end. And I couldn't believe how bad the facilities were. I've been going for about 20 years. I just had no idea how bad it was.
I'm not wrong, am I? It's completely different to the rest of the stadium. The rest of the stadium's very nice. I honestly thought Charlton, lovely family club. I've been there before. It's a nice stadium. And I mean, I really enjoyed myself. But yeah, I was shocked at how different the away end is.
Yeah, a disgrace on the proud name of Jimmy Seed. What about the next category, which is documentaries? And I think we've all gone for our best ever documentaries. We'll start with you, Mina. Yours is not a well-known choice. What do you like about it?
So mine is the football's greatest international teams, Brazil 1982. It's really short. It's 25 minutes. But I think it was, like, last week we were talking about the best ever World Cup and I nominated 86. I'm one of those old people that's like, oh, in my day, football was so much better. So
your day being like, about 4 years before you were born in this case.
Basically, most of the time. It's like, you know, I wasn't even alive or too young to experience any of it. But this particular World Cup had so many consequences in the things, in the sense that it changed football for many people. I don't know, maybe you could say Tele Santana, who was the coach of Brazil at the time, was the last real romantic coach of that team, or Jogo Bonito. It was just a fantastic World Cup because, you know, the clash of ideologies between the big match that was Brazil and Italy. And in many ways, the documentary really captured the essence, really captured the reasons why I have the philosophies of football that I have now and that are so ingrained in me. And I also just like it's amazing that you have Zico on there talking. You have different, you know, players giving their opinions on all of it, about the journalist who talked about how Spain was mourning the fact that they lost to the Italian national team. And I just thought the opening sentences, which I wanted to read to you because it's amazing. And it said, on the 5th of July in 1982, many felt the beautiful game died, where Brazil's finest team in the post-Pelé era succumbed to eventual champions Italy, where pragmatism overcame fantasy. The world wept for Brazil's fallen heroes and a style that dominated world football for over a quarter of a century. And I just feel like there's so much in that. That's so true. It's almost like one of the reasons why I have certain beliefs now, one of the reasons why I'm not that keen on sort of the Pep Guardiola style of football, is because Tele Santana broke my heart. That was an amazing team. And it was almost like they lacked humility. They wanted to attack so much at times that they just forgot about defending. And they had a great defense. And you saw this Italian side that was boring to watch, that had three draws, but that was so disciplined, that was so desperate. And there were all these social consequences to everything as well, because the Brazilian political scene was huge and it was all changing and it was dominating the headlines. Meanwhile, in Italy, you know, once again, they had their pride to look after because there was another scandal in Italian football. They needed to prove themselves, but they were really struggling. And it was just like, no matter how beautiful football is, at the end of the day, balance always succeeds. And that was what it was. It was pragmatic football. And I thought that that documentary really showed you everything, the highs, the lows, what it meant to both nations, what it meant on a wider scale. I thought it was really well written. I thought the interviews were amazing. And I just love that at the end, you've got the Brazilian saying, well, at the end of the day, it was a great generation. It was Serginho. And he was saying, but we lost. And he says so while wearing a Juventus cap with the logo on the side. I just thought that was fantastic. And yeah, so for me, it was just one of those, like, you know, there's a lot of these ones that are just overly hyped, or, you know, when you get all these documentaries like the Juventus one or the Manchester City one that just go so far to tell you that their clubs are amazing and people are amazing. But this was just like, oh, this meant so much more than just a football club that won or a national team that won. This was the death of a style of football. This was the rise of another, and it was just, I thought it was fantastic.
Mine was quite short as well, and it's Club for a Fiver, which is the 1995 documentary about Leighton Orient, which is notorious for the manager, John Sitton, who is the sweariest man of all time, who he's been promoted slightly above his station, and this documentary is basically just watching him unravel. At one point, he sacks a club legend at half time because he doesn't think he's playing well, and then he offers out two of the other players for a fight, and he infamously says, "You can team up if you want, and you can bring your bad word dinner because you'll need it." And it's this very, very funny portrait of someone having a really bad time, but it's actually a beautiful piece of work. It's very economically told because it's all done on a very small budget. It was actually a film project for someone's university course, so there's a real elegance in how they handle not being able to show any of the games. You just see these crazed team talks of getting everyone up for the latest games, whichever game is taking place. And then the screen cuts to black and just flashes up the halftime score, which is Brentford 3, Leighton Orient 0. It's just miles away from the polish you get with most documentaries now, but all the better for it, and also available to watch online. What have you nominated for this one, Matt?
I've got Graham Taylor, The Impossible Job, which I kind of... It's a similar style, actually, to the Leighton Orient one, even though the access is incredible, but actually it's very kind of simply shot. And you only see bits and bobs of games. It's all about, you know, Taylor's interaction with the press, Taylor's interaction with the players. It's actually, it doesn't bother showing much football. It just has the camera on him on the bench a lot of the time. Just seeing this man basically sort of unravel as the England manager. I love Graham Taylor, by the way. I've got a very kind of special place in my heart for Graham Taylor. But this was filmed over the basically pretty much the 2 years where he was trying to qualify for the World Cup 94, which England obviously eventually failed to. And it comes out with just some of the greatest catchphrases ever that have just stuck with Taylor and within football. I mean, we've got Hitler's, Carlton demand it, can we not knock it, do I not like that, what sort of thing is happening here? And then the brilliant one is that Holland game where Koeman should have been sent off for fouling David Platt, and he eventually bangs in from a free kick the goal that starts to unravel England's whole hopes. And Taylor walks up to the linesman, the linesman, he's berating the fourth official the whole game, and then he walks up to the linesman and says, just tell your colleague, the referee's just got me the sack. And I mean, it's incredible. He sat on the bench at times talking about how the press are going to portray things while the game's going on. He references like the sun and the mirror while games are going on. It's unbelievable. The access that was given for an England manager was just unbelievable. But then there's another side of it, because you tend to remember it as Taylor kind of unraveling in these crazy catchwords, and Phil Neal being just saying yes, boss, the whole time in a completely useless assistant. But then there's a moment in it which for me just absolutely sums up what a wonderful human being Graham Taylor was. There was a game, I think it might have been San Marino, where John Barnes is getting awful stick off the England crowd. The commentator saying, I've never heard an England player get this kind of grief from an England crowd. And Taylor is sat, and it's the old Wembley where he was a lot closer to the fans. And Taylor's sat in the dugout and he hears a fan say something racist about John Barnes. And he actually turns to him during the game and says, you're talking about another human being there, so just watch your language, son. And then continues to manage the game. It's unbelievable. If yet anyone hasn't seen it, you can still find it on YouTube. And it is the greatest, greatest documentary ever.
What have you got, JJ?
What have I gone for? Well, I was going to go predictably for something with Aberdeen. There's a few good documentaries on like the Knights in Gothenburg, and there's one called Team of the Decade about the Alex Ferguson teams from the 1980s. But that's basically just a season review, isn't it? And that doesn't count for a documentary, as far as I understood the game. So the only thing I could think of really was the all or nothing Man City documentary, which I know we've talked about already. I don't see why people don't like it so much. Like, it's just interesting to see behind the scenes footage. I don't really enjoy these documentaries that much behind the scenes, because even if you think it's real, whatever, it's still being put together, cut as a documentary, which is still a form of entertainment. So nothing is real. And if you consider the idea that, like, people saying, "Well, it's fake, it's all performance," but isn't everything a performance on camera? So if you put a camera anywhere, then by definition, like, you're not capturing what was really there, because people will act in a certain way. If you put a camera in front of someone, then they can't pretend it's not there. And if you, like, Man City players are always on camera, whether it's they're on TV or in training being watched, or their pals with their Instagram cameras and their phones, stuff like that.
This is why I don't like ones that are focused. Like, there's one on Netflix on Juventus as well. I think it was the first one at the time. And it's just like, it's almost like they're acting at this point. Like, I feel like when it's, I totally see where you're coming from. It's always a performance. But that's why I much prefer documentary, is when it's like looking back at something and it's like people's opinions and then clips. You know, like, it's kind of a little bit like why Senna was so good, you know, watching that.
Sure. But then the whole point of it is, I like like seeing the behind the scenes stuff, like you see where they're training and you get to see what the coaching looks like. That sort of stuff I find interesting to watch. Whereas, like, I just don't care about the actual documentaries. Like, I prefer the reviews. That's why the things like the Aberdeen team of the 80s, because you see clips of them training on the beach and then it cuts to them, you know, beating Bayern Munich in the Cup Winners' Cup. But you've got, like, with this Man City thing, you see behind the scenes stuff, but yes, of course, it's dramatized. It's entertainment. It's been cut in a way so there's three acts in every single episode, and there's a series arc. So everything is done there to be entertainment. But that, you know, football's not got that. That's why you can't go to a game and pay £80 for a ticket and then guarantee it's going to be great, because it's just random. Whereas a documentary, they've got to make it hit certain beats.
Did you like or do you like Sunderland Till I Die?
I think it's fine. But again, the whole point of it is you'll find characters who are your villains, who are your heroes. You'll find arcs, like, so individual story arcs for individual people. Then you find the conflict, and the conflict is what creates the drama, which is what makes people watch it. So even if there's nothing happening, you'd be able to make it much better.
I've always found with these, the things that always attract me to the documentaries, and why the Leighton Orient one, Taylor, and why I really like Sunderland Till I Die as well, is just seeing some of the workings that you can't actually believe happen. You'd just imagine it had to be more professional than that. And obviously, I just found with the All or Nothing, there was none of that. And Sunderland Till I Die, I mean, the new series, I'm not giving away any spoilers here, but the scene when they sign Will Grigg and the decision-making that goes on the January transfer window deadline day to sign Will Grigg is astonishingly unprofessional from the people in charge at Sunderland. And that is what I find fascinating in documentaries. So I think you and I probably take very different things out of these documentaries, which is interesting in itself.
Go beyond the headlines with The Telegraph's daily coronavirus podcast, a roundup of the latest news on the pandemic from our leading journalists, with analysis on the impact on health, business and travel every weekday evening. Search Coronavirus The Latest on your podcast app.
Shall we quickly move on to the final subject, which is a slightly throwaway topic, let's be honest, footballer's hair. And my nomination for this is the best footballer's hair ever. And I want to talk about Marcos Alonso, whose hair is a work of art. He looks like Morton Harkett of Aha in about 1986. You just don't see hair that beautiful anymore. He's got a wonderfully put together head of hair. I just don't think it gets enough love. It flies under the radar slightly, his haircut, but I'm in love with it.
How can haircuts get this much love?
I don't know what it is, Mina. I think it's because I really like Aha. I enjoy seeing that represented in a football pitch in 2020.
I saw this topic come up and assumed it's just because everyone's a bit worried about how their hair's going to turn out after all of this, because there's a lot of chat about how people are going to cope with their hair. I agree on Marcos Alonso. I agree on Marcos Alonso. I think he's got a wonderful, wonderful head of hair. It's so thick.
Yeah.
It's the thickest hair. It's lovely hair. I'm with
What's your nomination there, Matt?
It's not my nomination, but I when I saw that you were nominating that, I nodded. I nodded and thought, that's a great pick. And kind of wished I'd picked it. I sort of went, I went another way. It's not necessarily my favourite hair, but I'm doing it for good, not bad. It's The first time I was only really aware of a footballer's haircut that entered my psyche was Tony Daly, who he sort of, it's very hard to explain his hair. I mean, it was dreadlocked most of the time, but he would just have this kind of crazy, crazy thatch of it just plonked on the top of his head with not a lot around it. And he would do various things with it, going in all different directions and stuff. And to be honest, you look back at it now and it doesn't actually, you know, the things people do with their hair, it doesn't actually look that remarkable now. But at the time, everybody used to talk about Tony Daly's hair. It was a thing. And it was the first time I ever took notice of anyone's haircut. And it added to him because he was an incredibly exciting and frustrating player at the same time. And he was, at the time, again, he probably wouldn't be considered that fast now, but he looked super fast back then. Watching him live, it always felt like if the Holt End wasn't there, he'd just continue running, you know, straight out through Aston or something. And the hair made it. It was all part of it. It was all part of this flamboyant sort of guy. And yeah, it's just the first time I'd ever really thought about a footballer's hair. So that's why.
I completely agree with you about that, Matt, because I remember it was almost a scandal, Tony Daly's hair. It was this byword for absolute insanity. And yeah. I looked back at the pictures, I was like, actually, this just wouldn't stick out at all now. It looks incredibly normal.
He's basically got dreads, and it's just in a few different angles. And yeah, it wouldn't. It's nothing on what, you know, the Pogbas of this world and stuff have done with their hair. And, you know, other people who I think one of them is going to come up from a nomination. But you're right, at the time, it was a massive deal. It's like, this guy's mad. Look at his hair.
It was a simpler time. What have you got, JJ?
I'm surprised no one had Carlos Valderrama.
I think because it was so obvious.
Yeah,
I
know, exactly. My second choice.
Because that's what I thought the whole point of the thing was. Like, oh, wasn't that wacky funny here? And that's what you made all your players look like in Pro Evo when you could build your own character. Yeah, or make it pink now. But yeah, I went for David Beckham because, I mean, he sort of set the agenda of haircuts being linked to footballers, I thought. Especially in the 90s, you had Pretty Boy, Spice Girl, Beckham in the 90s. And then you had I'm a Captain Now, Skinhead. And then you had his sort of normal-ish haircut when he was at PSG and all the rest. Nothing really exciting to say about it.
Everyone should have a favourite and a least favourite David Beckham haircut.
Yeah.
The cornrows is surely the low point.
Oh, yeah.
Yes, yeah. That one should not
I do like the skinhead one, though, but I'm partial to a baldy.
I liked the Mohican.
Oh, that was quite good.
I quite liked the Mohican. There was an awful one where he dyed it really, really bleach blonde, and it was very kind of 90s, all in different angles, very, very bleach blonde, and it's not aged well at all. It looks terrible.
Yeah, yeah. Nor has my version of that in 1999 age well. It's if anyone ever visits my parents' house and sees the picture of me with peroxide blonde hair when I was 14, it's hours of fun. Mina, complete the lineup, please.
It has to be Ronaldo in 2002 with that blob of hair. It almost looks like a vajazzle. I don't even know how to bikini wax.
Oh my goodness!
It's so like horrible to explain it like that, but I don't even know what he was thinking to have that lasered little piece of hair at the top of his head. He at the time admitted that it was a bad haircut after a while when he did all these interviews and said that he did it so that it would take away focus from the fact that he had injured his leg and couldn't train and wanted to give someone and the people and journalists something to talk about so that he could concentrate on his training and get back to being sort of the Ronaldo that can win the World Cup, which he did, obviously. But that haircut, it was like, he's not the world's most beautiful footballer. And I just feel like there are things that you can do to make yourself look better. And he was like, he was actively trying to make himself look bad.
Did the job there, didn't it? Has anyone seen the viral video of this that's gone round? Because as we're talking about, everyone's worrying about their hair. And there's a video that's doing the rounds of this young lad who says to his dad, like, can you cut my hair? They've got the clippers because he can't go to the hairdressers at the moment. And he says to his dad, I want it like Ronaldo.
And he does that haircut.
And the video comes back and it's not Cristiano Ronaldo. He's got that haircut and the kid's in tears.
Oh, that's so mean. That's like a Friends episode, you know?
It's definitely worth a watch. But
it's in the show notes.
Very relevant shout, Mina.
That's it all for this week. You can contact me on Twitter if you'd like to before next week's episode. It's at Tom with an H Gibbs. We'll be with you on Tuesday next week. We need a full Easter break. We've been very, very busy sitting at home. Send us an email with that extra day if you'd like to. It's afcpodcast@telegraph.co.uk. We'll read out the very best of what you send us, and we're very happy to receive suggestions of categories you'd like included. You can even name your best or worst of that category yourself if you like. We are sure to include whatever you send to us. Don't forget to have a look for the podcast and subscribe to it. It's Telegraph Audio Football Club. Just look for that wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks to Joel Probe on the buttons, and thanks to you for your company. I'll talk to you again soon.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.